You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast, putting evidence back into soft tissue therapy.
And we're live. Hey, Bill. Welcome to the Sports Therapy Association podcast, episode 195, entitled Shoulder Assessment, Qualitative versus Quantitative, with my special guest, Professor Ian Horsley. He'll be coming up very shortly, clinical director at backinactionlimited.co.uk and plenty more, but I'm not going to start that now because it's a huge list and we're going to go through it in detail. Just to let you know, this is part one. If you're listening to the podcast or whether you've chosen to join us live in the live lounge, this is part one of a very special two-part shoulder series with two absolute giants from the industry. As I say, Professor Ian Horsley will be joining us for this episode. And then in episode 196, which will be recorded live next week, Treating the Shoulder Steps to Success, my guest will be hugely respected shoulder specialist Joe Gibson, also upper limb rehab specialist at Rehab for Performance. And like I say, that's going to be recorded live on April the 30th, Tuesday at 8 o'clock. So if you are listening to this podcast and you're thinking, actually, I'd quite like to be live so I can ask these people questions directly, and also gives you a chance to hang out with the other people in the live lounge, and that's all you got to do. Just come along to either YouTube or Facebook, the Sports Therapy Association Facebook page, and you can be here live. And when you do join us live, I can bring your questions up onto the screen and you can show off your fancy logo or your face. For example, people are coming in the live lounge now. We've got Cecily Hislop, who says, so happy you finally got up to this joint. That's true. I've got a little bit of a bias against anything above the waist and I get a bit lost. So I've got to watch out for that, how much, you know, I do that. But yes, we're up to the shoulder, Cecily. So I'm glad you're happy about that. If you do find that you've joined us and your message is not coming up on the screen and you're known as Facebook user, then that's because you haven't clicked the permission link. But hopefully there won't be any of that tonight because I've told you all about that a little bit. Anyway, so for those of you who don't recognize my voice, just introduce myself. My name's Matt Phillips. I'm the creator of runchatlive.com. And like I say, as always, this episode of the Sports Therapy Association podcast is being recorded live on a Tuesday at 8 o'clock on the Sports Therapy Association YouTube channel and Facebook page. Before we start this week's episode, I'd like to thank last week's guest in episode 194. Let's just bring his face up there for those of you who have joined us live. There we go. Ben Wybrow was with us. I say every week it was a fantastic episode and you should really go and listen to it. It is there on all popular podcast apps and it's on YouTube if you want to watch the video. It's also on the Sports Therapy Association webpage, which is the sta.co.uk. Fantastic episode for anybody who works or talks to people in pain, which is my kind of sarcastic way of saying it's for all of you. Okay, it's a magnificent, I mean, it's so good. They're all great, these communication experts, because they just help us gently realize that we're not as good at communication as we think. And he made a great point saying that we all feel that simply because we've chosen these careers of looking after people, that obviously the empathy just oozes from our bodies as soon as people walk into our room. It's what we do for a living. But because of the words we use and the body language we use, and how we comment once somebody said something, we're not as empathetic as we would like to think a lot of the time. The patient just doesn't hear that. So it's a great episode giving you a few little nuggets on how to actually let the patient realize the empathy you have got, as opposed to just relying on, well, they know I'm doing the job. They must know that I love them. So it's a great episode and just, he's a great educator. We also had, as part of the show, because it was based on a Sit in the Mud article that Ben did in the MSK mag from the Physio Matters team, we did a draw for somebody to win 3 months of free subscription to the MSK mag. And we will mention that at the end. So to see if you are the lucky winner of 3 months subscription to MSK mag. But anyway, I've left him down in the lobby for long enough. I would now like to bring up the guest for the first part of the shoulder two-part series, episode 195, Shoulder Assessment, Qualitative versus Quantitative, with special guest, Professor Ian Horsley.
You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast, putting evidence back into soft tissue therapy.
Hey Ian, how you doing?
I'm good. Good, thank you, Matt. Thanks to you for the invitation, and thank you for people tuning in live and the ones who download it and listen to it later.
That's very kind of you. Now, it's amazing to have you along. I hope I didn't make your head swell up too much in the various promotions I've done for it, because you are, I'm sure you will agree to yourself, but you are a massive name. You've been around for a long time contributing to the shoulder and more. So I think maybe to start, because hopefully a lot of people haven't heard of you, that's the whole idea, otherwise we're all just sitting in this echo chamber. Would you be so kind? I know it's tricky because it's quite a long CV, but how did you get to where you are today and so kind of respected for working with the shoulder and educating people about the shoulder?
Okay, so a quick potted history. I always wanted to be a surgeon. My direction of study in my life was to go to university and do medicine and then be a surgeon. But I lost a little bit of focus when I was doing my A-levels. Didn't quite get the grades I needed, but managed to get some grades that got me to Liverpool University to do a combined first year of physiology with the option in the second year, if I did well, to do medicine. And that's where I got to what I now call a lucky break. I broke my back playing rugby at university. And while I was being managed and treated there, I realised that doctors really didn't treat anybody. They managed people. And out of the continuum that I went through, it was a physio who actually sort of treated me, did things for me. And so I was lucky enough to finish my year at Liverpool and transfer to Manchester. To the then what was called Withington Hospital School of Physiotherapies, because in the dark ages, okay, we weren't at university, we had schools of physiotherapy. And then while I was an undergrad there in my second year, the local rugby team came and said, we'd like a physio to work with our rugby team, please, preferably somebody who knows something about rugby. And I was doing my outpatient placement. And they said, oh, well, Ian plays rugby and he's doing all right in his outpatient placement. Why don't you have him? And that's how I ended up getting into rugby. And as anybody knows, they get a lot of shoulder injuries in rugby. So I had to quickly upskill on managing shoulder injuries in rugby.
So you weren't tempted, because we've had a lot of guests who have become great educators and therapists, and because they were injured, and sometimes because they noticed that the care they received wasn't as good as they'd wanted, it's like, well, I'm going to do something about this. But for you, you said it was your back, which you had a problem with. For a stage, were you like, right, I'm going to help everybody's backs, and then you just realise there's more shoulders to work with, or how did that come about?
Do you know what? I was a typical rubbish patient. So my treatment was, I was putting a full body plaster cast, so all around my thorax, up to my hips and around under my shoulders from there. And every second week, I had another one applied over the top. But I played tennis for the university in a cast. I even tried to play a game of sevens until I got sent off when the referee realized I had a plaster cast on under my shirt. It was just, I don't know, never really thought about it. And just enjoyed getting into physio, really. Mm-hmm. when I started, I thought I want to be a pediatric physio for some reason. I don't know what it was, but then just things changed based off what I did with the rugby club.
My father's from Wigan, and he'd be so proud listening to you now, because he's always having a laugh at kind of rugby union players, men with handbags down south, and saying the league is where the men are. So he'd be so proud to get there. See, there's an example.
There you go.
That's what you get when you cross the border. So, yeah, excellent, playing tennis in a cast. So, yeah, you already mentioned, I think, 14 years, was it, physio for England Rugby Union?
Yes, yeah.
6 years for the elite playing squad, which always sounds amazing.
So at that time we had a big squad. So we had the first team and second team. So it was the first team and what was called the A team. From there, so trained together during Six Nations, and they'd select the team to play on a Saturday, team to play on a Friday, which was the A team. So worked a lot on there. I was lucky that during that time, it was 2003, so we won a World Cup then. So I was part of that wider group looking after that squad. So it was good times. And that change from working through from amateur to professional was really, really nice from the huge change that the way we were looked after as players and support staff was fantastic.
Amazing. Yeah, we've had some interesting, rugby does come up with its fair share of injuries, doesn't it? We have some fascinating conversations even recently on concussions and the theories and changes and misconceptions about that. But tonight is all about shoulders. So like you said, yeah, a lot of shoulders injuries in rugby. We were chatting a little bit off air and the feedback we get, and I've suffered it myself. I look after runners. So like I said in the intro, anything waist up, and I get it. Because if you don't work in something, then you just don't feel that confident about it. But the shoulder joint in particular, I don't know it's the way it's presented when we learn the anatomy and physiology, but it's kind of a little bit of a fear joint. Is that right? Do you think fair to say?
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, I do a lot of postgrad teaching on it. And I ask people, you know, what is it that scares them about it? You know, in essence, the glenohumeral joint is two bones, which is one bone less than the knee. And people seem a lot happier around the knee. And I suppose there's a lot more instability around the joint itself, but when you think of that, the glenoid is part of the scapula that which sits on another mobile platform, which is the thoracic spine, which sits on something else. So there's a lot more connections, if you like, that then can influence sort of locally as well as globally the shoulder.
I think that's it. I think you just nailed it as well, because we are taught it's the most unstable joint of the body. So that makes us fearful in treating. So imagine how it sounds to patients when we go, well, you do realize the shoulder's the most unstable joint of the body, but don't worry, we're going to fix you. But it's interesting. I think it's because it's got that massive range of motion and so many tests, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on.
But if you look at it in sport, you know, look at it in gymnastics. It doesn't look unstable when you see what they do on the rings in there. You know, it lacks osseous bony stability, like the hip, where you've got a deep socket for that. But it's got fantastic neuromuscular control. That's what you're looking for around the shoulder, and hence the sort of the title of the talk tonight. Really, for me, you know, there's some clever things going on around the shoulder that maybe numbers don't capture.
Brilliant, great segue. Good segue into the title. Yeah, so. Yeah, as we said in the introduction, tonight, part one, shoulder assessment, qualitative versus quantitative. I guess we should start off really, not only are there two words, which are quite difficult to say if you've had a couple of drinks, but yeah, could we go into maybe defining them and then distinguishing them so our listeners kind of realize what we're talking about here?
Okay. So my current part of my job is I'm the upper limb lead physio for the UK Sports Institute, which used to be called the English Institute of Sport. And I work in high-level Olympic and Paralympic sport, and there's a massive focus on numbers, okay? Strength, power, range of motion, rate of force development, lots and lots of numbers that are measured. And I am not a great fan of that, because so that would be your quantitative stuff. So force production, how much weight you can sets, reps, you know, newtons, kilograms, whatever from there, you know, degrees of range of motion. Whereas for me, and this is sort of nicking a phrase off Johan Elphiston and Andre Vleeman, what I look for around the shoulder, as with anywhere else in the body, I want to see beautiful, effortless movement. And that is a sign of a good neuromuscular system. So this is qualitative. There aren't any numbers for it from there. And so it's based on something that's experienced or observed, really. So that's which is difficult, because I can, when, you know, having to describe what I can see that looks effortless or effortful, it is an objective opinion, but it's an experienced objective opinion that I can tell somebody's movement quality is getting better or getting worse. And that's I look at how well they move, and obviously the feedback from their patient on whether or not they're getting pain or they're getting their symptoms. Because you can measure strength and you can measure range of motion and force production and things, and you can still have poor, ugly, effortful movement, and your patient can still be having symptoms. So I do sit in as a square peg in a round hole in the institute.
It's really interesting, because it's like, and I'm thinking of previous episodes. I've been sitting here, and I'm nodding as you're saying it, but then I'm thinking of
talking to particularly strength and conditioning coaches, they're saying that we should all be using dynamometers more, because then we've got a tangible way of measuring improvement, and we can, if we're working with a team, we can show that, like, the coaches or the bosses and the managers, look, this guy's getting better, he's getting closer, or and how important it is to have something quantitative. But now you're sitting on the other side saying, hold on, we're going over the top with quantitative now, where it's not actually, quantitative is all very good, but it doesn't necessarily correlate with full recovery as well as we might think.
Yeah, so you know, the quantitative stuff is good for performance. Okay, I agree when we're looking from a performance, right? But from a rehab and from a motor control aspect, it's other things. Because if we take what we said earlier about the shoulder joint having little bony stability, okay, but it's a neuromuscular control around there. We've got to make sure that joint stays stable is that sort of feed forward mechanism, that little bit of pre-activation of a low level of the rotator cuff to prepare that joint for some activity that they can do some wondrous things in gymnastics or some incredible throw in judo without somebody's arm coming out there. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, this pre-activation about 60 to 120 milliseconds before the move, which is, you know, which is imperceptible, really, if you think about it. But if you look at some of the research that's been done in sports, say, if you look at cricket or look at tennis, that if you're stood 22 yards away on a cricket pitch to somebody bowling a ball at 90 miles an hour for you, you haven't got time to see that ball hit the deck and decide what shot you're going to play. What happens is, because our brains are very, very clever and spot movement patterns that we don't even appreciate, you the best batters can see how the ball is, as a bowler comes in, as he sets up to deliver, they know roughly where it's going to be, and they can preempt that. Similarly, in tennis, when the ball coming at 150 mile an hour, you can't react to a ball coming at 150 mile an hour, but our brains are very, very clever at doing things that we don't know they're doing.
So are you suggesting then that because the shoulder is dependent, the way it functions, yes, it's got this instability, but it's got so much of neuro ability as well, that's why in the particular case the shoulder joint, the pendulum does swing more towards we should be doing qualitative as opposed to quantitative in a joint where maybe there is kind of just kind of flexion extension?
I mean the same, you know, we know the same is to all the joints, to stop an ankle sprain, or, you know, with the to get damage at your knee, or if you get an ACL, it's the same, but they've got a little bit, you know, if you look around the knee, you've got a round bit on a flat bit, which is not a great bit of stability, but a little bit more stability from both of the cartilages, which are in there. But you've got massive muscle at the front, massive muscles at the back. That gives it stability. Ankle, we've got a nice little mortise for a bone to go in, and lots of muscles around there. So they've got other bits. But the shoulder, it's a ball and saucer. You know, it's flat. It's not even round. It's pear-shaped. You've got a little thickening around the edge, which is the glenoid labrum, which is about 7 millimeters thick. Okay, there isn't a lot there to hold it apart from the cleverness of the information and the message coming from the brain that controls the cuff. And then once we get that right, we can produce incredible forces. I mean, we know that, you know, from in baseball, where they're throwing a ball, you know, between 90 and 100 mile an hour, at the point of release, there's about 1¾ times body weight traction force on that arm. But you've never seen a pitcher in baseball lose his arm at all from there. You know, it works really, really well to sustain some high forces, but we've got to have that platform for everything to work off. And, you know, we need the platform of stability of the shoulder blade, which then the cuff sits on, that then can give stability, dynamic stability to the humeral head on that sort of flat pear-shaped surface of the glenoid.
Fantastic. Just going to remind people who are joining us in the live lounge, feel free to ask questions if there's anything you need clarification on. I've even got a little image of the shoulder joint in case you're getting a bit rusty then. Just say, Matt, can you flash an image up on the screen? Then, yeah, just don't let this all go beyond you if you're not quite sure. We can take it at whatever level you want. I'm wondering whether of people who are rehabbing. I mean, we're talking at the moment of people who are in kind of some stage of rehab and they're in pain. And is it a case of whether there should be more quantitative base in the beginning of rehab or later on, or is it, should the qualitative be there from the very beginning or especially at the end, or what's that in your experience?
So again, one of the things, you know, I try to explain to patients when I'm looking at things, it is you can ride a bike that's got a slightly buckled wheel. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's not a comfortable journey. Okay. So what I'm looking for, I want the good mechanics, and what I don't want a buckle wheel that makes it low effort for you to pedal and it makes it a comfortable journey. So first of all, I need you at low level to be able to move your arm beautifully. You know, I see patients in clinic, and these are not elite athletes. If you ask them to take their arms out to the side and they get to about here, they look like they've got 20 kilograms in their arms as they fight to get their arms up above the head. You know, if they can't do that without any weight, you know, just imagine when you start to put some weight on there. So I want to get somebody moving effortlessly at low load, and then we can start to change that. We can add load as long as it looks beautiful and relatively effortless, and then we can change the speed, and it needs to be beautiful and effortless. Well, because that's the sign for me of skill, of performance. So if we take something a sport that's on telly at the moment, snooker. If you watch them playing snooker, and you'll see somebody down at the bottom end of the table where the pink and the black is with the white, and they'll hit a red and it'll go straight into the center at the top left hand pocket from there. And that's 12 feet away from them. And you think that's easy. Go and have a go. Go and have a go. And that's just to pot it, not to get the ball to whiz around the table and come back and sit on a sixpence. So when you see, you know, a gymnast doing their stuff, if you see a tennis player serving, you know, it still looks relatively easy, apart from unless you're watching Rafa Nadal, okay, which, you know, I always compare Federer to Nadal. Federer, effortless, beautiful, very few injuries in his career. Nadal looks like he's fighting a bull every time he plays, high incidence of history throughout his career.
Yeah, interesting distinction. I'm listening to you about the importance of the beauty of the movement and allowing that. And I'm wondering whether it reminds me, this has come up a few times now, it's on my mind. At Therapy Expo last year in November, people like, I'm sure you're familiar with people like Angela Jackson. Andrew McCauley, his name also escapes me. Both of them and more people had some great talks on, particularly it was Andrew who was drawing attention to the fact that still one of the biggest kind of precursors or something which indicates the chance of injury is have they been injured before, which kind of suggests that the rehab we've been doing all of these years for somebody is missing something. Because if that person has got a really high chance of coming back with another hamstring strain or shoulder injury, then maybe we're missing something from the rehab. So they were talking a lot, both of them, about this idea of chaos, of that we are not rehabbing properly in the way that they're going to use it in sports. So I'm thinking of that with the shoulder as well. It's very easy to get somebody to, we're talking about rehab at the moment, we'll do assessment in a second, but you could put someone through all of the kind of, like, you know, planar movements, but you're not creating the chaos which might happen, not so much in snooker hopefully, you know, but in other sports, you know, where they are going to have somebody trying to stop them or knock them over or you know, and change angles. So I guess that ties with what you're saying. To prepare for chaos, you need to have that quality of movement.
Yeah, you know, you take somebody from, you know, they telling them what they're going to do, knowing what to do, then to the unexpected. So it's not often that a shoulder will dislocate when you know what's going to happen. Yeah. It's when, you know, when you're not ready, and not necessarily, you know, people just might be in a relaxed position and sneeze and can dislocate the shoulder. Whereas, you know, that you can tackle somebody equivalent of a 30 mile an hour crash at rugby and bash into them and get up and run across. So that, yeah, it is about thinking of all, you know, all their different facets and you know, trying to prepare them for those uncertainties, really. But you know, when we talk about the shoulder, the thing that I don't think gets looked at enough around the shoulder when we're rehabbing is looking at proprioception, awareness of joint position sense. You know, we routinely do it for the ankle. You'll get somebody who tests them. You'll stand them on one leg. Can you balance on one leg? You know, can you do it with your eyes closed now? Can you do it on an unstable surface? And that's for a comparatively, relatively stable joint. But when we do the shoulder, and again, when I'm teaching, I ask people how many people routinely assess joint position sense, proprioception as part of their assessment and their rehab. How many people rehabilitate proprioception of the shoulder? Because that is the mechanism that's going to tell the brain what's happening at the shoulder. Because everything that we do anywhere in the body is brain derived. For, you know, when we're training and we're trying to get a peripheral movement stimulus to we're trying to change a centrally driven stimulus. So when we're giving exercise, okay, but for every one external peripheral stimulus we give, there's 30 stimuli coming from the brain. So we need to train the brain, okay, to sort our joints out. And obviously there we're talking about the shoulder joints, but it's the same for any joint around there. So proprioception is massive for the shoulder. And that will be, you know, one of the early things to assess and to work on with it.
Right. Well, I can hear listeners, either live listeners or I'm looking in the future now, podcast listeners, I've just flipped over their pad now and they've just got their pen from behind their ear because we're looking at something which maybe they should be adding to the rehab of the shoulder they're not. So yeah, give us an idea of early or late stage, you know, things you should be incorporating which do test the proprioceptive abilities of the shoulder.
So we can do a, you know, simple thing. You can put them, so if you can see me from here, we take away the visual stimulus, blindfold on the eye, you can put their arm into a three-dimensional position on in space, okay, their non-injured shoulder, and say, can you replicate that with your shoulder that you've come to see me with? Mm-hmm. That's
clever.
That's called contralateral mirroring.
Yeah.
Or you can take the joint into a position, so say supine, 90 degrees abduction, take them into 80 degree, something like around about 80 degrees, like say 75 degrees of external rotation, leave it there for 5 seconds while they're blindfolded, bring them back to point to the ceiling. Can you replicate that 75 degrees? And then you can measure the error, the joint position error from there. And whether you undershoot it or overshoot it will give you some bit more information about where their proprioceptive, their joint position sense is in there. You know, a lot of the stuff, if you look in literature, and I think when I've spoken to people when I'm teaching, it uses lots of expensive equipment like isokinetic dynamometers and force detectors, that you can use these really, really simply things to get an indication of how that joint is functioning. Because unless you give the brain some information, it can't do anything. So the quality of the afferent information, the information coming from the shoulder joint to the brain, decides on how good the response from the brain is to protect that joint, you know. And I hate this saying because it's an American, but garbage in, garbage out. So if you've got inappropriate message coming from here because your proprioception is down, then your brain can only act on what information is given, and it gives you some faulty movement information or stability information back.
Excellent. That's lovely. That's a lovely idea of the blindfold. And just can you, again, using the asymptomatic arm as a measure of what to try to achieve with the symptomatic arm. One could say there, but though there, because you talked about measuring angles, you're still using a quantitative approach there to
for some feedback. So, you know, I'm not particularly a lot of the time worried about the range. We're looking for this. We're looking at something that's very specific about proprioception, how accurate that has to be. So when we start to get to the neuro side of things, then we do need a little bit more.
So one of the arguments that we read about, or which kind of like says, quantitative is the way forward, is it is tangible. The danger maybe of qualitative, depending on what kind of assessment or exercise you're doing, is that success is measured by the practitioner or the patient of how they feel or whether it hurts or if they're tired, and it's all kind of difficult to measure and show progress. Is that kind of overstated by people who are trying to get you to buy a you know, some kind of quantitative equipment, or have they got a point?
Yeah, I mean, you've got that. There was a nice little blog came out by Claire Minchell this week talking about using handheld dynamometry and things, and talking about the things, you know, you can get variability just, you know, from how you encourage your subject to produce force, you know, how much you shout and scream at them, you know, that volitional response with it, you know, the position that you know. So again, if we think about the shoulder from a testing strength, we talk a lot about internal and external rotation strength and ratios. And we might test them at 90 degrees abduction from here. And it will generally be an isometric force. Okay. So again, are those muscles working isometrically in that position in sport, in life? No, they're not really from there. We're testing them in mid range. Yes, but you will tend to dislocate more to outer range. Okay. We test concentric most of the time, where we know that we need some eccentric, some lengthening from there. So again, when we start to think about the quantitative stuff, then we need to look into more detail than in more specifics of what it tells us, because, you know, in sport, in baseball, that 90 mile an hour throw, the arm's going at something between about 7,000 degrees a second it's rotating at. Okay. And we know that the force produced is relative to the speed in which you move. Now, we haven't got a bit of equipment that will measure that. You know, an isokinetic dynamometer goes as fast as about 500 degrees a second, no matter what thing. And so we're taking values. And for me, I'm thinking, so what is the validity? Yes, it's a value, but how does that rate to 9,000 degrees a second with it?
Hey there, Matt Phillips here. Sorry to interrupt the podcast. Just seconds to remind you that if you're looking for beard grooming products, there is a Sports Therapy Association discount code that will get you 15% off at The Brighton Beard Company website, thebrightonbeardcompany.co.uk. Yes, I am biased, what with Brighton being my hometown, but the Brighton Beard Company really do offer an absolutely amazing selection of luxurious beard balms and impeccably scented oils, all handmade in small batches with 100% natural ingredients. Their current spring collection, for example, contains bergamot, coriander, thyme and lavender, giving you a fresh and energizing essence with both citrusy and peppery notes, making it the perfect gift for you, a family member, or any friend with facial hair. Go to thebrightonbeardcompany.co.uk and get 15% off now by entering the discount code STA15. Doesn't include already discounted bundles.
Okay, what about assessment then? Is that different? Someone's coming in yet? Because a lot of our listeners, when they move, basically, I don't know how much you know about the syllabi for sports therapy, but when they move from level 4 to level 5, and there's a lot of fuss over this, basically they're just introduced about 30 different kind of orthopedic tests, with a lot of them on the shoulders, and they have to learn them and reproduce them, and there's a question these days as the validity of these tests for some of the reasons you've just mentioned now, because it's all very well testing apprehension tests of some form, and I think also we've had papers which have shown that maybe the limitations of, I don't know, tests like raising the elbow from the, you know, the back, the base of your back and stuff like that. Do you think that even at the level of just assessing patients who come in, that these tests are a little bit flawed and we should be doing tests which are based more about quality of movement as opposed to measuring them and looking at force production and stuff?
I think, again, that those tests, and last time I looked, I think there was about 152 manual orthopedic tests around the shoulder. There's probably been another one developed while we've been talking tonight around there, which, as I say to people, there are that many because the reliability of them is poor with it. So some of those tests may be able to identify injury around there, which is slightly different. So if you've got a tear in the cartilage ring around your joint, around your labrum, well, that's going to affect how the joint works, because that one of the things the label does, it helps keeps that negative pressure in your shoulder joint, which sort of sucks the ball into the socket. It's like a gasket. And if you tear that, then air can get in and you haven't got that negative force sucking the ball in. It's also an attachment at 12 o'clock and at 6 o'clock. At 12 o'clock, you've got the long head of biceps that inserts. 6 o'clock, you've got long head of triceps. Inserts. So if they're loose, then that affects how they work. So some of those help us identify possible pathology and a structural pathology that may need surgery from it. But again, you know, thinking about some of the tests, even if we talk about, you know, as I mentioned about internal external rotation, there's a good study done at Liverpool looking, you know, so if you test internal rotation of your humerus, the main force producing sort of up here are going to be pec and lat, okay, which are big global accelerator muscles. When we test external rotation, it's going to be the cuff, it's going to be a bit of supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor, bit of posterior deltoid. We've got massive muscles versus little muscles, okay? And we talk about how that's going to give stability to the joint, because we can't really isolate muscles on their own. And what we really want to look at, if you're trying to get that balance around the cuff, is the rotator cuff. So posterior cuff, infraspinatus teres minor, and anterior cuff, which is subscap. So if you test subscap with a belly press, you get a significantly more, this was from the study in Liverpool, significantly more subscap than you do pec and lat. But that's not a particular vulnerable position when you're pressing on your belly, but from there, or a functional position for it. And similarly, if you go around your back, which is Gerber's lift off, where you lift your hand off the back, again, there's a little bit more, there's more subscap than the others. But again, it's not a position that generally is injurious to your shoulders. So we need to have some form of idea of you know what's going on around the shoulder and choose our test judiciously. There are some that I use regularly around that that give me information about things.
For example, yeah, which
So one of the things that I use quite a lot, I do like O'Brien's test. So bring your arm into 90 degrees of flexion, bring about 20 degrees of horizontal adduction, and point your thumb down, resist shoulder flexion. Now, this test can give you several different results. You can get, if it produces pain, the location of the pain can indicate possible structures that are damaged. So if you get pain over the top of your shoulder around your AC joint, it could indicate an AC joint problem. If you get pain at the front, it could indicate a superior labral tear, cartilage tear, or long head of biceps. If you get pain or discomfort at the back, it could indicate a posterior instability. Okay, but then if you go into supinate and externally rotate your arm and repeat the test, and these become less positive, that then, okay, that sort of confirms that, because you're winding structures up. So I quite like that, but I won't just rely on that. I will do some secondary tests to work out what's going on.
That's one. You're going to have to give three on this show. So that's one test you like to use quite regularly. What else?
Okay, so
when it comes to the shoulder.
Apprehension test is quite good. So you bring them into this position and you take them into external rotation, and the original test is they feel apprehensive that the shoulder's going to come out of joint. And if you give them a slight stability with an AP on the front, they feel better. So that's telling you they've got some anterior instability. And then if we class the AC joint as part of the shoulder girdle, so again, love a scarf test. Horizontal adduction inflection across the body.
What do you like with, because some of these tests will rely on kind of a numerical values given either from the patient or something noted by the practitioner in terms of stiffness or endpoint. These are all quite qualitative, aren't they? They're quite subjective. It depends on the individual. It's difficult to reproduce depending on who's haven't got great intra or interreliability. But the whole question about qualitative versus quantitative, is that, does that something that you could talk about with regards to assessment?
Okay. So again, when I'm doing an assessment, then what I'm looking for is what a meaningful task. So what action does that person do that brings on their symptoms?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it could be, I don't take it, taking the coat off. It could be throwing a ball. It could be doing a press up. And so once we've got their meaningful task or something that appropriates that meaningful task, then what I tend to use then would be improvement testing. So messing about, because we sort of chatted earlier, poking or stroking. I will do things to try and facilitate some muscle recruitment or inhibit some muscle recruitment.
Some kind of symptom modification sort of stuff.
Yeah, but also if we think about how the force is produced around the shoulder girdle, 50% of the force that's produced around the shoulder girdle comes from the waist down, mm-hmm. 30% comes from the trunk, and 20% comes from the shoulder girdle. So I can influence the activity of that 50%. So I might get them to stand on one leg. Okay. So just arbitrary, stand on your left leg. Does it work better or the same? Stand on your right leg. Worse, better, or the same. Okay, I'm going to put band around your ankles. I want you to abduct against resistance your right leg. Worse, better, or the same, or your left leg, or extend. And I will look at influencing the chain to see how we influence their meaningful task and the outcome of the meaningful task. Because often, you know, as we mentioned earlier about these repetitive injuries that people get, it's because it's a defect in the chain. And I do quite a bit of work of seeing sort of failed surgery. So people have had reconstructive surgery from there. Generally, they tend to be rugby players that I see because of my background that consultants will send. And when I look, I will find a deficit in the kinetic chain, you know, and just by, you know, and the simple test that I do with all shoulders is I get them to do a mini squat on one leg, and I look for their alignment of hip, knee and ankle. As they do about a 30 degree squat, do the hip, knee and ankle stay over the top of each other, or do you get that valgus collapse and the knee moving inside the foot? And that will tell me that we've got some lateral stability issues around the pelvis, which will influence how the shoulder works.
Very interesting. I like that idea. That's something that people can pick up on changing or looking for symptom modification by not just the angle of the arm or anything. That's quite limited there. But yeah, what's happening with the rest of the body? Can you repeat those percentages again? You mentioned
so it's 50. So waist down. So from sort of hips down, 50%.
Mm-hmm.
From waist up, so core, whatever you want to call it, from 30%, and then shoulder girdle, 20%.
That's very interesting. You could progress and regress just by sitting down, lying down, taking that.
And with that in mind, that's why you need to know what their meaningful task is. So because we do tend to assess people in standing in clinic, but their fault might be when they're sitting doing something. So we ought to assess them in sitting, because if their fault is in sitting, we don't really have to worry about that 50% because that's not involved. So it's that 20%. That 30%, which is their sort of trunk and core.
And this was something else I was thinking, because you mentioned like a lot of the people you see are athletes, rugby players. But of course, the importance of having that reactivity in the shoulder and being assessed and rehabbed properly is quite significant for other populations as well. Thinking of the elderly, for example, it's really important for them. So when it comes to assessing them, probably it's not going to be standing on 2 feet for a lot of them. It's going to be an issue that is when they are seated or something, or in bed or something, or getting out of bed. So. Yeah. It's even more important to make it a meaningful assessment.
Yeah, you know, I work with Paralympic athletes, so I see, we get a lot of shoulder injuries in our wheelchair athletes.
Yeah.
Working out from them, you know, and how they're positioning the chair, how their chair's set up as well. Yeah, so we need to try and make our assessment as close to what they do. Now, it's different, you know, if you've got a javelin thrower and he's, you know, throwing a javelin 5 meters and his arm's going at 10,000 degrees a second, you can't really replicate that in your gym. So you'll have to look at something that might replicate their symptoms, sort of. And most of the time, it's if you go into abduction, into elevation, that will tend to be a provocative thing. So we might use that in clinic. And as I, you know, as I say to my patient, we might be able to clear that in a clinic, but that does not necessarily mean that when you go back to throwing your javelin, and I will say, right, what I want you to do now is go and throw your javelin and get back to me, because yes, your pain's gone and you can do everything that hurt in here, but you didn't come in telling me that was your pain. Go and throw your javelin and tell me what you like now, throwing your javelin or doing your ironing or pegging your washing up or whatever it might be.
Clever, very interesting. And I guess level of fatigue will come into play as well, because, I mean, sometimes these people only start having issues when they're halfway through their whatever event it is, match or race or...
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, if it's a swimmer, you know, and they get it at the end of a training session, I say, look, we'll try and schedule your appointment to see me when you finish, when you're in the state, so I can see what's going on. Because by the time you've come to see me, which is maybe 2 days later, and you've not swum, there's nothing for me to see. So yeah, go and provoke it, and when you provoked, you know, come and see me.
That could be so tricky. I mean, in an ideal world, I mean, I used to do a lot of gait analysis, and the situation was these people coming saying, "Oh, it hurts me after about 10 miles." I'm like, "Mate, I really need to see you after 10 miles, because what I'm seeing now, especially with running, is going to be totally different to how you're moving." And a few people, you know, you're just stabbing yourself, your business model a little bit in the foot, because. You had to have some really good therapeutic alliance to get them to go and do 10 miles and then come and see you. It's like, come on, mate, sort it out now, will you?
Well, what we do, so I do, I clear with those. We put them on the treadmill in the gym and I put them on and I'll say, right, there's a bell. When your pain comes on, ring me. I'm here all day. But literally, when your pain comes on, I'll come and have a look at you. Yeah.
It's so true. It's great. Question, people, you're very quiet in the live lounge. What's going on? Are you scribbling things down? I want to hear what goes on in your clinics or when you're doing rehab or assessing or that sort of stuff. I wanted to ask you about different kind of like methods of assessment, which either qualitative or quantitative. There's been a lot kind of written about one repetition max kind of thing, you know, that does that come into play as much with the shoulders? Is that something which eventually you incorporate, or is that more for lower limb?
So, you know, as we get into the performance end, so if you're thinking from a sport point of view, once I am happy that they've got beautiful effortless movement at different speeds and different load, then they will go and work the S&C for that. But what's important for me when I'm assessing force production is how quickly they produce instant force. So what we need, as I sort of mentioned earlier, we need this 60 to 150 milliseconds before they move. We need the cuff just to sort of hug a little bit. What I'm looking to do is I'm looking how quickly they might react when I perturbate them, give them a nudge. That's what I'm looking at. I'm not looking at their total force. And, you know, and if we talk about, you know, some of the theory around stability of the joint, so we think about the kinetic control, sort of Comerford and Mottram, you know, you only need 25% of your maximal voluntary isometric contraction to get stability. So I'm not, you know, I'm not bothered how strong you are to keep your joint stable. I want you to be able to react quickly to produce that 25% ish from there, because what tends to happen is if we produce force, then the muscles that produce force tend to produce stiffness and rigidity, and that's what changes the movement. You know, we use the bigger muscles rather than the local system from there. So often in sport, the answer to anything is make it stronger. Mm. Okay. Now, for performance, that is the case, but not necessarily for injury prevention around the shoulder, because we know that muscles can create instability just as well as they can control it. And the muscles which are strong around your shoulder, so pec and lat and to some degree deltoid, they're too far away from their center of the joint, and they being dominant, they start to create some instability. Whereas our cuff, which is right next to the ball, they're the ones that work at a low level consistently to keep that humeral head within sort of 2 millimeters of the center of the joint when it's moving at speed and you know, 9,000 degrees a second, whether you've got 1¾ times your body weight on it as well.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, you come up with those stats, it really does kind of show the chaos and stuff that's going on, and they have to react so quickly. Yeah, really interesting. And you've been around a long time, so you've seen lots of kind of things come and go and names used and different programs, but kind of functional testing has been praised and then demonized. But when you talk about quality, then I'm kind of thinking when you're looking for more of a global, can they perform this movement beautifully? Like you say, that kind of makes me think, well, basically we're talking more about functional testing and seeing how they can move collectively. But that sometimes gets criticized a little bit as not being as accurate because you can't distinguish what individual muscles. But are you suggesting that sometimes we have to forget about the individual muscles and just look how they are performing globally?
Yeah, your brain doesn't really register muscles. It registers movement. And you know, over the last 2 years, a lot of my reading and study has gone more into some of the new stuff around brain training and how it's all about accessing your brain by doing weird things. And one of my courses I can change the range of motion in somebody's arm by getting them to smell something. Okay. I can change their range of motion by getting them to put their eyes in a certain position or put their tongue in a certain position because these affect your cranial nerves So if we think about, you know, if we coach movements rather than the muscles, I think we'll be better. Because if we think about one of the muscles that gets trained a lot around the shoulder is serratus anterior. Okay, massive muscle of the shoulder blade. It does everything that we want the shoulder blade to do. It upwardly rotates it, it posterior tilts, it externally rotates, and it also protracts it. If you do a Google search now of exercises for serratus anterior, out of the top 10, probably 8 or 9 of them will be protraction exercises. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't ever remember having to coach protraction for the scapula. What I have to coach a lot of it is upward rotation. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if I want serratus to work as a better upward rotator, I have to make serratus work as an upward rotator, not as a protractor. With it. So if we think about the movement that we want around any joint, but around the shoulder girdle, we that will help us better. Knowing what muscles do that is okay. But we think, right, what movements do they produce? What are we lacking? You know, so it generally is humeral external rotation as we go into elevation, and then upward rotation or posterior tilt or external rotation of the scapula. So looking at those, and I'll coach those movements. You know, don't have to have EMG on to see is it serratus that's doing that or is it middle trap that's doing that. I'm watching. Okay, is the scapula doing what I want to do and training that movement regardless of what the muscle is.
Very interesting. And yeah, it's great to hear professionals like yourself who are on top of the research and everything talking about. We've had a few professionals talk about the vestibular training and things and how that's now being looked at a lot. Paul Coker, who you've probably come across in your travels, he's very much into that at the moment and his course is talking about it. Again, Andrew Jackson's very much talking about it as well. And it's a lot of studies been done on it. And it's it's interesting that because once we go through so many stages, once you've kind of like reached a few decades in the industry, things just get blown out of proportion now. But I'm wondering how long it is before we go over the top with vestibular training, because it's pretty, like you say, sometimes just smelling something or, you know, just doing a movement with your eyes beforehand. It's opening up a whole, I could just see the DVDs being made as we speak, but it is something pretty exciting and novel that seems to be filling a gap, you know, and it should be.
I think in therapy, we've got a problem that we like to be on the next bandwagon. You know, and very often we get that bandwagon and we jettison all other things because, you know, this is the new kid on the block. Now, different things work for different people. Every person you see is an N equals one. Okay. And so there aren't really recipes. You need to know what works for that patient doing that movement at that point in time. And though it's a little bit more challenging, I think if people, certainly around the shoulder, we discussed how people tend not to like the shoulder, be a bit wary of it. I think they try and fit recipes and formulas to it. But if when I'm teaching, I'd say, well, we're going to do some play. Okay. We're going to try things and look at improving symptoms. We're going to look at improve quality of movement, improve feedback, less pain, better range for the patient. What do we do? Okay, what do I have to do? I poke this and stroke that and touch this and tell you to, you know, change your posture, things, you know, and work out, right, what do we need to do to change that, and then come up with a strategy.
Great stuff. Brian Huxley here is just, I'm looking at your comments, people, whether Brian Huxley says, vestibular rehab, very important and underused in my opinion. Yeah, definitely. I wonder how many have been kind of using it without even realizing we're using it. Because when you do invent and look for symptom modification and what makes this better, what makes this, sometimes I think we've been kind of dipping into it already without even realizing it. But yeah, definitely something people should be looking into. It's one of the kind of the, when people say, what CBD should I be doing? Should I be doing more of this? I'm like, have you thought about maybe some of that? Because it's probably something you haven't considered. So yeah, very interesting. And also it made me think of, again, with rugby players and concussion, because that's obviously potentially a big area where it's been inhibited or because of concussion and may not be involved in rehab as much as should be. So yeah, good point, Brian. I like it. Right. It's somehow it's already 8:57, nearly 9 o'clock. So
you need my wife to come and pull the fuse.
I love that. I love that. She must know you so well.
Yeah.
But yeah, great. Well, no, what I'm conscious of is I don't want to keep you for longer than 9 o'clock. What, there's a couple of things. Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of a challenge, which I should probably have mentioned before you came on the show, but I like to try and remember at the end of the kind of 57 minutes of loads of information and tips, one kind of theory into practice. So thinking about our audience who are a lot of the sports therapists, they're probably seeing a lot of athletes and non-athlete populations who have got shoulder issues. What's kind of one little thing that you think some people could take away from this, which they could put into practice on tomorrow or whenever next week, which maybe they might not be doing at the moment with regards to qualitative versus quantitative assessments of the shoulder. You don't have to answer yet, but have a little think. I'm going to just refer to something I mentioned earlier on, but yeah, one theory into practice which they can take away. I mean, some of them might not need it, but some of them it might be a great tip. Whilst Ian Horsley is having a think about that, I just got a message. I was going to tell you who's won 3 weeks free subscription to MSK Mag, but actually I've just received notice saying that we haven't had time to collate people together to get a draw. So what we're going to do is we're going to roll it on for another week, and then we'll pull everybody together. So obviously people who have already done a post, what you had to do basically, and we said it in the last week's podcast, was if you do fancy 3 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 months subscription, free subscription for MSK Mag, which has got, like I say, it's got some fantastic articles. It's where we found Ben Wybrow's article, and it's got some marvelous authors in there, which will help your therapy and everything. Then all you're going to do is basically just do a post on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, if you like, and tag in @UK_STA. So it's @UK_STA. And just say, I'd love to win 3 months of free subscription to MSK Mag because, and make up something which will make me laugh. And we will put them all together and we will get next week's guest. I mean, it was always going to be Joe anyway, who's going to draw it. So we'll get next week's guest, Joe, who's going to draw a name out of anybody who does that post. So if you're listening to this podcast, you've now got a week. If you're listening to it, well, it depends. You've got until the 30th. To put a little post out there. I'd love to win 3 months of free subscription to MSK Mag because I'll make sure that goes in the show notes for this one to remind you, but it's a great opportunity. You might even decide you like it and then pay what is not a lot of money per month. I think it's a tenner a month to get the basic subscription for MSK Mag. Anyway, so we're not going to draw that. It'll be next time. Back to Professor Ian Horsley. Theory into practice. Over to you.
Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, I think about considering the influence of the kinetic chain. It's massive. So you can see the, as I say, a simple thing by, as I say, standing on one leg, seeing if that changes, or standing on the other leg and seeing how that changes, adding some resistance to right hip abduction or left hip abduction or right hip extension or left hip extension, and look one at the quality of movement and the feedback from the patient. It's really informative from that, because it's hugely important in how force is generated around the shoulder and movement patterns. And if somebody's got an insidious shoulder injury that's come out of the blue with no mechanism, just check about whether they've had in the last 12 months, if they've had any lower limb injuries. Because Joe will talk about it next week. They looked at a paper, they produced a paper looking at professional footballers who had shoulder injuries. And when they looked through them, most of them had had lower limb injuries in the year before are from there, and they found a deficit in the kinetic chain.
That's a great take. That's something people can put into practice. If you've got any shoulder injuries in there, assessing rehabbing, just see what they can do standing on one leg, or maybe with a band for some hip abduction or something. Great. Play around with it, people. And then you can let us know maybe next time, or you can always email questions in to matt@thesta.co.uk. Or if you really want to comment or leave a question, then the best place to go is to the Sports Therapy Association YouTube channel and stick a comment or a question in there. It just stays far more alive than Facebook. Facebook is over once a new post appears. So YouTube stays on Google. So try and use the YouTube comment section on the Sports Therapy Association channel to put any questions in. And I will make sure it gets answered one way or the other. Fantastic. Well, look, it's 9:02. I just wanted to bring up your website in case people we'll do a few links in the show notes about how to contact you. I'm just going to bring this up on the screen. We can still hear you if I put it on full. So worth going out to check www.backinactionlimited.co.uk. So that's all the W's dot backinactionlimited.co.uk. Professor Ian Horsley is Clinical Director of Back in Action Rehabilitation Limited. On Twitter, it's @back_in_action. On Instagram, it's @backinactionphysio. Like I say, the links will be in the show notes. On Facebook, look up Back in Action Rehabilitation. Loads of great information being put out there, obviously for free. So it's worth checking them out and keeping up to date. Not just on the shoulder. Obviously, there's loads of other stuff there as well. But I believe in terms of courses and things, Ian, have you got anything coming up?
I do shoulder courses called Sporting Shoulder, and that's for a company called HDPPN. And I believe we are just organising one for the back end of the year and next in June, where I'm doing a webinar on return to play considerations for the sporting shoulder. So looking at the tests that are out there and what use I think some of them are.
Fantastic. If people want information on that, can they get it from your website, from Back in Action Limited?
Yeah, from there. The best of things, but I don't know about it. Probably a younger demographic. I'm old, and most of the time I'm on Twitter, still call it Twitter, not X. But if they contacted me through there, I respond a lot from there. But the other, whatever, Facebook or Instagram, that'll get to me. My secretary manages those.
Okay. You're not yet on. You're saying you're not yet on TikTok now or Snapchat. Haven't quite.
Do you know what we have? our youngest member of the practice has got us a TikTok chat channel from
Fantastic.
There, but I haven't seen it. tells me it is a proper thing, and she's not taking the Mickey on it. So we'll have
all
to.
Right. I'm going to check that. No, I'm going next to check that out. That'd be great. Fantastic. Yeah. So, and we'll put links in the notes to all of that as well, in case you want to keep in contact with Professor Ian Horsley and what's happening there. So fantastic. Right. Like I say, next week is part two. If you are listening to the podcast and you'd like to come along and ask questions directly, then just head along to YouTube, Sports Therapy Association YouTube channel or Facebook page. 8:00. We can look out for the adverts and set a little reminder. I'd recommend YouTube normally because it's just easy to get to and you can leave comments in there that last for longer. But yeah, we're going to have episode 196, which is Treating the Shoulder, Steps to Success with, as I say, special guest Joe Gibson, who's a fantastic shoulder specialist and educator. And it's going to be a great show, and it'll be a really, we'll obviously touch on some of the things that Professor Ian Horsley has mentioned tonight. She's in Liverpool as well. You're based in Liverpool. Are you both?
I'm in York.
No, you're in Yorkshire, aren't you? Of course. Where did I get the Liverpool link with you?
I do stuff at Liverpool Hope University.
There we go. That was it. Yeah. But yeah, as you will hear from Joe's gracious tones, definitely born, bred and raised in Liverpool. That'll be next week in episode 196. We'd love you to join us live if you can, but if not, you'll find it on all popular podcast apps and also the live recording on YouTube. Thank you to those of you who joined us in the live lounge tonight. Brian Huxley says, really enjoyed the session, guys. Fabulous seeing, and a big thank you. And also Brian Huxley says, a fellow Yorkshireman. Excellent. That's good. A little bit of bonding there. And Louise Aker as well says, sums it up nicely, saying, thank you. It's been really informative. Gives a better way to look at the shoulder joint in rehab. And thanks, guys, for joining us live. It makes all the difference. I do love, it just makes it a little bit unique. I've always liked recording these things live, so I appreciate it. And thanks for all the feedback from people who do download the podcast. If you have listened to the podcast, you've enjoyed it, do please take a couple of moments to leave a review or a rating, because it just helps the good word of guests like Professor Ian Horsley get out there more. It's directly related to what appears in Google at the top. So do please leave a rating, particularly on Apple Podcasts, if you'd be so kind. Right, that just leaves me to say thank you again to Professor Ian Horsley for giving up your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody, and have a good evening.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. Hopefully we'll see some of you next week. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast, putting evidence back into soft tissue therapy.